From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Quentin Tarantino's new movie, Jackie Brown, has brought back Pam Grier, the queen of the 70s blaxploitation films. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we hear from Pam Grier. And we feature an interview with crime novelist Elmore Leonard. The movie Jackie Brown was based on Leonard's novel, Rum Punch. L.A. Confidential has won the Best Film of the Year award from both the New York Film Critics Circle and the Los Angeles Film Critics. We'll hear about the making of the film from director Curtis Hanson and star Russell Crowe. And linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the origin of the word cult. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Senator Ted Kennedy says he appreciates all the condolences the family has received since the death of his nephew, Michael Kennedy, in a New Year's Eve ski accident in Colorado. The Kennedy clan is assembling for today's wake for Michael. The funeral is tomorrow. A medical examiner in Chicago says comedian Chris Farley died accidentally of opiate and cocaine intoxication. The autopsy report says the overweight comedian also had a problem of narrowed arteries supplying his heart. Two banned Cuban baseball players are still in the Bahamas despite an offer of asylum from the United States. The State Department has offered asylum to pitcher Orlando Hernandez and another Cuban player, but so far, the offer has been refused. Pat Duggins of member station WMFE reports.
Cuban pitcher Orlando Hernandez is holding out for an all-or-nothing deal in the Bahamas. That could be a risky move, since in the past, Cuban ballplayers seeking asylum in the Bahamas have been sent home. Hernandez, his common-law wife, another banned ballplayer, and five others were rescued 5 days ago. They ran aground near the Bahamas and lived on rations of water, sugar, and Spam for 4 days. The United States offered Hernandez asylum on New Year's Day, but he said no. Orlando Hernandez is the half-brother of Florida Marlins World Series MVP LeVon Hernandez. There may well be a financial motive for Orlando to remain in the Bahamas. If he's granted asylum in the United States, he can't go for a lucrative baseball contract as a free agent. If true, then Orlando would be following in the footsteps of LeVon Hernandez. He fled to the Dominican Republic before signing with the Florida Marlins. For NPR News, I'm Pat Duggins in Orlando.
Defense attorneys in Terry Nichols' Oklahoma City bombing trial requested that the judge impose sentence rather than the jury today. They argued that emotional outbursts from relatives of victims would prejudice the jurors. But Judge Richard Mache has rejected that motion, and the defense has begun presenting its case in the sentencing phase of the trial. The woman who dominated tennis in the 1920s and 30s has died. Helen Wills Moody died yesterday at a convalescent home in Carmel, California. Jeff Berry of member station KCLU reports.
Moody was known as Little Miss Pokerface and Queen Helen. She won 31 major titles during her long career, including 8 at Wimbledon, 7 at Forest Hills, and 4 in Paris. Moody was best known during her time for overpowering her opponents by hitting the ball harder and with more force than any woman she faced. She won her first U.S. women's tournament in 1923 and retired after winning Wimbledon in 1938. Her record was 18-2 in singles matches at the Whitman Cup, the women's version of the Davis Cup. Moody never took tennis lessons and learned the game by watching other players while growing up at the Berkeley Tennis Club. Moody died at the age of 92. For NPR News, I'm Jeff Berry in Thousand Oaks, California.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up about 8 points in light trading. On the NASDAQ, the composite is down a point. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, it's been a low-key day on Wall Street. Bloomberg's Paul Ehrlich reports.
The year's first day of trading so far is much like 1997's last, indecisive. Stocks were mixed much of the morning, with AT&T declining after a court ruling removed barriers to the Baby Bell's entry into long distance. Several of the Baby Bells gained. Stocks stayed in neutral even after the National Association of Purchasing Management said its manufacturing index read 53.5 in December, down a couple of points from its November reading. That points to a more subdued economic growth. Investors usually are happy about that. It indicates less inflation and stable or lower interest rates. Microsoft opened higher amid speculation it will unveil a $1 billion investment in cable giant Telecommunications Inc. at next week's Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. I'm Paul Ehrlich.
Thousands of Spanish coal miners have begun a three-day strike in an effort to stop the government from bowing to European Union demands for production cuts. Some 4,000 jobs are to be eliminated under the EU plan, which aims at reducing the need for state subsidies for the mining industry. It was another record year for Hollywood. Movie watchers shelled out more than $6.2 billion last year on tickets. Box office totals for 1997 were about 8% over the previous year's record, but they were generated as much by higher ticket prices as by an increase in the number of tickets sold. Some highly skilled computer professionals will be exempt from overtime pay in Washington under a new state rule. Companies will no longer have to pay overtime 2.5 times to computer programmers, analysts, and developers. That's if they earn more than $27.63 an hour. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music in more than 200 neighborhoods across the United States, where browsing is a fine art. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Quentin Tarantino's new film, Jackie Brown, is reviving the career of Pam Grier. In the 70s, she was the queen of black action films. In Jackie Brown, she plays a middle-aged flight attendant who smuggles money for a gun dealer. After she's busted by ATF agents, she sets up a scam to get herself free of the agents and the gun dealer. Here she is holding a gun on the gun dealer, played by Samuel Jackson, who she suspects is considering knocking her off so she can't betray him.
The way I see it, you and me got one motherfucking thing to talk about. One thing. And that's what you are willing to do for me.
I can get your lawyer.
Let's be realistic. Now, sooner or later, they're going to get around to offering me a plea deal. And you know that. That's why you came here to kill me.
I ain't come over here to kill you.
Hey, it's okay. Now, I forgive you. Now, let's say, if I tell on you, I walk. If I don't, I go to jail.
Uh-huh.
I want $100,000 in an escrow account in my name if I'm convicted up to a year or put on probation. Now, if I have to do more than a year, you pay another $100,000.
I can do that. But you know I got that problem, and all my money is
in Mexico.
Right.
Well, I've been thinking about that, too. And I got me an idea.
Well, let me hear that. If we friends again, you point that motherfucking gun somewhere else.
Back in the 70s, Pam Grier usually played a sexy, tough-talking, two-fisted, sharpshooting avenger, doing battle with pushers and pimps. Grier was an action hero years before women action heroes were common in mainstream films.
She's bad, she's beautiful, and she's back. She's Pam Grier, and when a woman's this hot, you can never get enough.
How about that?
Next is Coffee, a young nurse who's seen her 11-year-old sister destroyed by drugs. Now she wants to find out who's responsible and pay them all back. She turns into a one-woman hit squad on a trail of vengeance lined with hitmen, prostitutes, and thugs. It's Pam Grier in an explosive story of action, danger, and retribution.
All your friends are dead. Why kill them all?
Coffee.
I spoke with Pam Grier in 1990. She told me who she modeled the women in her films on.
For me, the films that I did, Coffee, Foxy Brown, and Sheba, were based on the women, the female characters in my family, who weren't very physical, but yet they were very strong women, but yet trying to maintain a sense of femininity. And my characters were based on my aunt, my mom, my grandmother, and some of the other women that lived in the neighborhood, that if, you know, they would protect their children with, you know, physical violence if they had to. And I guess for any woman, I think any woman would, whether she's strong or not.
Of course, they didn't go around shooting men in the groin like your
characters. No, but I
did.
Bet you they would if someone tried to attack them. I know where their knee would go if someone would try to steal their purse or hurt one of their children. I know exactly where their knee would go, or a broom or a brick or a skillet.
I think your first film was Black Mama, White Mama. Describe the part you played in that.
Well, it was a takeoff of a film that was done with Sidney Poitier and Tony Curtis, Terry, called The Defiant Ones, right? And, or no, 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 what was it? Yeah,
yeah, the Defiant
it was,
ones.
The Defiant ones.
Where they're handcuffed together,
right,
they're both prisoners?
So all of a sudden they did a female version of us escaping from a prison, defiantly trying to survive. So I guess, and it had a different title, Chains of Hate. Right, Chains of Hate. And they changed it to Black Mama, White Mama. You know, I'm sure that was to pull in the, you know, the box office. And it was about two women escape from prison, chained together, and how they help each other. And my co-star, Margaret Markov, was a ballerina.
Now, there became, in your movies, I think, scenes you almost had to do in the films. I think it must have gotten to the point where you almost had to have a scene where you had a long, drawn-out series of fistfights with other women.
Yeah, I think that was some subtle, you know, subtle, I don't know what you would call it on the air. I'm trying to find a better word for it. I don't know if it was on the part of the filmmaker or that they really like to see women be physical or do physical things or fight each other. I remember that there were a lot of movies in the 50s where people really were excited to see women, you know, roll around the floor and fight. And I used to see it in my neighborhood, and I didn't like it. It used to bother me, you know, and it still bothers me. It's amazing because I have this strange contradiction. I have an aversion to violence, and I often look like Mary Poppins the way I dress, and I have that mentality. And then while I'll do a film, and it's the antithesis of how I really feel. I think the way I do a film, I see it, and it's something that my mother and my grandparents used to say to me, before you cast stones, walk a mile in someone's shoes. So I think the roles that I play are I try to play someone who has that rage and violence and try to do it well. And I don't think it's something that I just want to do in my career from film after film or that I had to do. I think I was the only one that was really good at it and made it look convincing.
Let me get back to some of your films from the 70s. You know, we were talking about how there was a fight with women in several of the films. Mm. There was also castration scenes where you'd shoot somebody or have another way.
Must have been a metaphor.
Well,
metaphor.
How did these end
something.
Up being an almost trademark in your film?
Well, I think it wasn't to be taken seriously. The many of the scenes in the films weren't to be taken seriously. The castration was for people to I think it was like a modern monster movie where you would see something so horrific and people would like, yeah, good thing. That's what the bad guy deserves. He was such a bad guy. And people who have different imaginations will see different things from it. And I think the only castration scene possibly was in this movie, Foxy Brown had one. And it was basically tongue-in-cheek and a bunch of metaphors, and I never took it seriously.
Another thing is that in so many of your scenes, your clothes were draped in such a way, and you were positioned in such a way as to be the sexiest. So tell me what it was like when they would be positioning you so that you'd be showing off, you know, more cleavage or whatever.
You can't really hide my cleavage. It's just there, unfortunately. I was one of those well-endowed children. And I think, you know, all of that was exploited to sell tickets on behalf of the filmmakers.
Did that bother you, or did you just get into it because you knew that there was a certain camp value in this?
No, it was camp, but it was also an age where nudity in the 70s, we were still riding that wave of, you know, that free love and romping around Woodstock naked and our bodies are beautiful and why should I be ashamed of my body and that. And black women were never appreciated as that woman on the podium. She wasn't in advertising as much. She wasn't considered as beautiful. And black men didn't have these, you know, these black female sexy images to also feel good about their manhood. And I think that was an accumulation of why, you know, I draped and I was sultry and smoke and all those adjectives that they describe me as.
Pam Grier, recorded in 1990. She's starring in Quentin Tarantino's new film, Jackie Brown. The film is adapted from a crime novel by Elmore Leonard. We'll hear from Elmore Leonard after a break. This is Fresh Air.
The new film Jackie Brown is based on the Elmore Leonard novel Rum Punch. The novel has just been republished, but with the new title Jackie Brown. Quentin Tarantino is a big Elmore Leonard fan and has optioned several of his crime novels. Tarantino convinced John Travolta to star in the 1995 adaptation of Leonard's novel Get Shorty. Elmore Leonard is one of America's most popular and critically acclaimed crime writers. His novels include 52 Pickup, Freaky Deaky, Kill Shot, Stick, and Glitz. His new novel, Cuba Libre, will be out in a couple of weeks. One of the things Leonard shares with Tarantino is an ear for dialogue. In 1995, I asked Elmore Leonard about why he emphasizes dialogue in his novels.
I like dialogue. I've always liked dialogue from the very beginning. When I started 44 years ago, I was influenced by writers who were very strong in dialogue. Hemingway, John O'Hara, Steinbeck, a writer not many people know about, Richard Bissell in the 50s. Pajama Game was made from one of his books, 7.5 Cents. I like dialogue. I like to see that white space on the page, in the exchanges of dialogue, rather than those big, heavy paragraphs full of words. Because I remember being feeling intimidated back in the, say, in the 40s when I first started to read popular novels, Book of the Month Club books. I would think, God, there are too many words in this book. And I still think there are too many words in most books. But dialogue appeals to me. If I can set a scene, and this is what I do. I write in scenes, and I always write from a character's point of view so that the scene takes on the character's sound, at least to some extent. The sound even goes into the narrative.
When you started writing crime fiction, were there places that you would hang out just to listen?
I would hang out in Detroit, Frank Murphy Hall of Justice, which is the criminal courts, and watch examinations, little trials, rather than the, these are the pretrial exams to find out whether a crime has been committed or not. And then finally, by 1979-80, I was spending time with the Detroit police. And I did a piece for the Detroit News on homicide section. That was the first and only piece of journalism I've ever done. And it was the kind of piece that maybe you'd spend 3 days with the homicide cops and then take a day to write it, and that was it. But I was with them at least 3 weeks before I even wrote a word, and got to know them, and they trusted me, and they showed me their case files. I could just sit there in the squad room and listen to them.
And what would you say struck you as being most different about the way cops talked from the way your friends or colleagues talked?
Well, the way cops talk, they're not as educated for the most part. They remind me of professional soldiers, professional non-coms, a guy who's been a sergeant in the Army for 20 years or so. But I respected them. They really wanted to close cases. I saw that nobody was dragging his foot. They were all working hard. And they liked what they were doing, and that inspired me.
Do you think you would have made a good criminal? Let's face it, in a lot of ways, you have the mind. You know, you say most of your stuff isn't from research. You just, you know, sit at your typewriter and think it up.
Well, I can think of that, but I wouldn't have the nerve.
Mm-hmm. Are you a confident guy? I mean, you know,
I'm confident about my work, but right. My work. Yeah, right. But that took about 15 years, you know, to gain confidence in what you do. I couldn't imagine walking into a bank and saying, give me what money you have on top of that little alarm system that the last bill is lying on, and don't give me any dye pack, and don't give me any funny money or monies with the serial numbers, listed. If you know enough about it, I think you can get away with it. I think bank robbery would be pretty easily, even though 9 out of 10 bank robbers are caught. And I think mostly because they tell other people what they do, and because they're not really professional about it. They need money for drugs.
Now, a lot of your guys are talkers, and they could talk their way.
They have to be talkers.
Yeah, right. They talk their way into things and out of things. And can you do that?
No.
So you couldn't do in real life what your characters do, verbally?
Oh, no, never. No. See, the beauty of it in a scene where you end the scene with a line, with the perfect line, you know? But you write in the book, and you have months to think about it.
Right. Now, do you, like, 5 minutes or 2 days after the moment has passed, think of a good last line you could have said in real life, or do you not think in real life in those terms?
Well, in real life, I'm sitting on a bench at Aspen at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, dead tired. I've come down the mountain. A woman skis down 25, 30 years younger than I am, puts one boot up on the bench and says, I don't know what's more satisfying, taking off my boots or, and then she used an expression for sleeping with somebody.
And you said?
And I said, huh, huh, like that. A little, and that was probably 15 years ago. And I've been trying to think of it doesn't even have to be snappy, just something, a decent comeback, you know.
What would you have wanted to communicate to her?
Just something clever. What would Woody Allen say? That would have been enough for me, yeah. I hadn't thought of that before either. I should have put myself in Woody Allen's. And he would have said something a little out, you know.
Well, there might have been a difference between what he said in real life or what he said in a movie.
Well, that's true. I don't think, it wasn't an invitation. She was simply describing how she felt.
Now, I know you were a drinker for many years. When you stopped drinking,
mm-hmm.
did drinking change in your novels?
Yeah. No, the drinking didn't change. I had a little bit more energy then for writing, and I think my books got better. I quit in, when did I quit? 77. It's been 18 years. And I think from the late 70s into the 80s on that my books have gotten a lot better.
Did your characters drink any more or less when you stopped?
No, they continued to drink. I couldn't stop them. They were still drinking Early Times and Jack Daniels. No.
What is it still like for you to write alcohol scenes when
no problem
you can't drink
no.
Do you particularly enjoy it or anything? Is there a way to?
Oh yeah, because they enjoy it. They enjoy it. I have in the book I'm writing, Karen Sisko, the marshal, and her dad, who's my age, are sitting in the backyard drinking Jack Daniels, sipping it and talking, and they really enjoy it. And I can understand that, but I don't have any desire to drink, thank God, because I know if I did, I would, I'd get drunk again. I'd become a drunk.
You started your fiction career writing Westerns.
Yeah.
Tell us about one of the Western heroes you created.
Western heroes. Did I create any?
Western characters.
Oh, yeah. Hombre. I like that character a lot, which Paul Newman played.
In the movie?
In a movie, yeah. Yeah, I thought I was very proud of that one. And also I liked Valdez's Coming, which Burt Lancaster did. Valdez's Coming is my favorite Western that I wrote. And at the time, when I read it now, I can see my style beginning to change into what I'm doing now. Really not what I'm doing now, but it began to change.
More dialogue-oriented?
Yeah, a little more dialogue, a little more characters, a little more human. I'm loosening up a little bit. And that's what I finally learned, because I had studied Hemingway so closely and learned a lot, but I didn't agree with his attitude about life, about himself. He took everything himself, everything so seriously. But your style comes out of your attitude, what kind of a person you are, you know, your personality, how you see things. Are you optimistic? Are you funny? Are you grim? What? This is all out of your attitude. And once I learned that, then I had to find other writers to study and imitate.
Well, how would you compare your attitude to Hemingway's?
Well, I don't see that much. There is that much to take seriously in everyday situations that come up that people worry about, or people worry about things that might happen, you know, which is a big waste of time. I don't worry.
You don't worry?
I don't worry.
So this is one of the differences between you and Hemingway. You don't worry about things.
No.
Don't brood about things.
We know how seriously he took himself, right? With that shotgun he put in his mouth.
Right.
No, I don't see any reason to do that.
Right.
I don't take my work that seriously. And I think that's what keeps me loose. If I try to write, if I catch myself trying to write, I'll fall right on my face. I'll see it. If I see in the prose that I'm boy, look at me writing, I rewrite it. I rewrite it because because I think it's distracting.
Elmore Leonard recorded in 1995. His novel Rum Punch was adapted into the new film Jackie Brown. Leonard's new novel, Cuba Libre, will be published later this month. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's Samuel Jackson in another scene from Jackie Brown.
Yo, yo.
I need you to look up.
You check out some music while you're sitting in the car. Take the key.
Which one's for the car?
This one right here. Use that little black thing there to turn off your alarm and unlock the door.
What do I do?
You ain't gotta do nothing, man. Just point it at the car, push the button, you hear a little ooh, ooh, ooh. That'll mean the door's unlocked and the alarm's off. Get in. Okay. Play the volume loud as you want to, but don't touch my levels now. I got them set just like I like.
Okay.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Los Angeles Film Critics and the New York Film Critics Circle have voted L.A. Confidential the best picture of 1997. Coming up on this archive edition, we hear from the director, Curtis Hanson, and star, Russell Crowe. And linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the origins of the word cult. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The movie L.A. Confidential has turned out to be one of the most acclaimed films of 1997. It's won Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Screenplay awards from the New York Film Critics Circle and the L.A. Film Critics, and it's nominated for 5 Golden Globe Awards. On this archive edition, we have an interview about the making of the film with director Curtis Hanson, and a little later we'll hear from star Russell Crowe. First, let's hear a scene from the film. Kevin Spacey plays Jack Vincennes, a cop who consults to Badge of Honor, a TV show like Dragnet. He is dancing at a party for the show. Later in the scene, you'll hear Danny DeVito as Sid Hudgens, a scandal sheet reporter in cahoots with Vincennes.
I'm the technical advisor. I teach Brett Chase how to walk and talk like a cop.
Brett Chase doesn't walk and talk like you.
Well, that's because he's the television version. America isn't ready for the real me.
Is it true you're the one who arrested Bob Mitchum?
Uh-huh.
These Badge of Honor guys like to pretend, but being the real thing must be a thrill.
Why don't you and I go someplace quiet? Because I'd love to give you the lowdown on Mitchum.
Big V! Jack Vincennes!
Hey!
May I have this dance?
Of course. Karen, this is Sid Hutchins from Hush Hush Magazine.
Hello, Karen.
Hello yourself.
Mm-hmm. What's that about?
We did a piece last year on Ingenue Dykes in Hollywood. Her name got mentioned. Hey, Jackie boy, a friend of mine just sold some reefer to Matt Reynolds. He's tripping the life fantastic with Tammy Jordan.
Sorry, I lost you for a second, Sid.
Contract players, Metro. You pinch him, I do you up nice feature next issue. Plus usual 50 cash.
No, I need another 50. 2 20s for 2 patrolmen and a dime for the watch commander at Hollywood Station.
Jackie, it's Christmas.
No, it's not. It's felony possession of marijuana.
Actually, in circulation 36,000 and climbing, there's no telling where this is going to go. Radio, television. Once you whet the public's appetite for the truth, the sky's the limit.
Before directing L.A. Confidential, Curtis Hanson was best known for directing 2 big hits, the thriller The River Wild with Meryl Streep and Kevin Bacon, and the suspense film The Hand That Rocks the Cradle. Hanson also co-wrote and co-produced L.A. Confidential with Brian Helgeland. I asked Hanson why he wanted to make L.A. Confidential and how he first came across the story.
Well, it all started with the book. I read James Ellroy's novel for pleasure about 4 years ago, and I read it not looking for a movie, but just because I'd read half a dozen of his other books and thoroughly enjoyed them because I think Ellroy is a unique voice in contemporary fiction. What happened with L.A. Confidential, and what I was not prepared for, quite frankly, was the degree to which I got emotionally involved with the characters and involved in a rather complex and surprising way, because when I met each of the major characters, I didn't like them. But as I kept going, I got emotionally involved and ultimately really began to care about each and every one of them and their personal struggles. And the more I thought about it, I just thought if I could capture this experience for a movie-going audience, I would have a unique movie.
What are some of the things that you've seen in period films that you wanted to avoid?
I didn't want this to be a picture that was an homage to a style of another era. I wanted, my number one directive to my collaborators was, let's create the world of L.A. Confidential, Los Angeles 1953. Let's pay great attention to the detail, but then let's shoot it as though we don't care about the detail. Let's shoot it as though it's a contemporary movie so that the characters are in the foreground and their emotions are in the foreground. So my film references were more what I wanted to avoid rather than what I wanted to do. And, of course, Dante, being a cameraman, was just all over that. He got what I was saying immediately, and he took it one step further, which was he found the key to the lighting in that example, which was that L.A. Confidential would be lit in a naturalistic way, which is where the audience is aware of the source light, where the light is coming from in each scene, which is sort of diametrically opposed to the way classic film noir is lit with the you know, highly stylized black and white with the vivid dark shadows that bisect the screen and so forth.
It's a really interesting period in Los Angeles history that the movie is set in. It's a period when, you know, there's a show like Dragnet that's imitating the cops, whereas, you know, the cops in L.A. Confidential want the heroism and celebrity of the TV stars, and the politicians are tied into some of the corrupt parts of Hollywood. The tabloids are covering it all. Everything, as depicted in the movie, is corrupt in this part of Los Angeles. You grew up in Los Angeles in the 50s, didn't you?
Yes, I grew up in Los Angeles, as in fact did both my parents. I mean, Terry, that's the fascinating thing about Los Angeles in the early 50s. So much of what was beginning in Los Angeles at that time, in that period of optimism and economic growth after World War II, is still with us today, for better or for worse. You know, television as this powerful image-making machine that was used in a very deliberate way by the LAPD to sort of sell the image of this new police force that had been reworked into a military model based on the Marine Corps in World War II. And the result was a police force that was empowered in a way that no force ever was before, because of that TV image, they felt they could do no wrong, and in fact, the public felt they could do no wrong. And the birth of modern tabloid journalism as we know it, Danny DeVito in the movie plays the editor of Hush Hush magazine, who is the equivalent of our, let us say, Confidential magazine. And as he says at the beginning of the movie, radio, television, once you whet the public's appetite for the truth, the sky's the limit. Well, that's where we're living today.
Right. It's funny how timely in its own way this 1953 era movie is, because you've got the beginning of the tabloids, you've got corruption in the LA police force and brutality in the LA police force. Did you expect to be making that kind of, with the LA police force, I'm sure by the time you decided to do this movie, there was already a lot of investigation into the police force. It was post-Rodney King, probably.
But yes, of course, the book was pre-Rodney King, obviously. Brian and I started working on the script post-Rodney King, but pre-OJ. And in fact, you know, one of the cards that we got in one of our first research screenings that I found very gratifying was somebody had scribbled on the back of the card, "Are we supposed to think of Ed Exley, the character that Guy Pearce plays, as being a young Daryl Gates?" That's the kind of question that you want people asking, because they're taking what they see in the movie and projecting it to the life that we all live with.
Another really potent idea in the movie is that there's this ring of prostitutes who, with the help of plastic surgery, are made up to look like Hollywood movie stars. Kim Basinger plays the prostitute who's made up to look like Veronica Lake. And that whole idea that sex will be even more exciting if the person looks like a Hollywood movie star, so we'll just, like, make these prostitutes into those looks, is really a very interesting one. Tell me what spoke to you about that idea.
Well, first of all, for me, what the overall theme of the movie, and it's a theme that I've dealt with a little bit in other movies, but this is the first time I've been able to deal with it as fully, and also in Los Angeles, the city of manufactured illusion, is the difference between image and reality, the difference between how things appear and how they really are. And, of course, the Kim Basinger character sort of sums that up for the audience, because she looks like Veronica Lake, but in fact, you know, is something else quite different. You know, interestingly enough, that idea of prostitutes that look like movie stars is based on fact. One of what I've always found interesting about Elroy's technique is that he takes things that are true, such as Mickey Cohen, Johnny Stompanato, the major sequence in the beginning of the movie that's called Bloody Christmas, where the policemen sort of riot and beat up some Mexican prisoners. That's all based on things that actually happened in Los Angeles at the time. And then, of course, we spin off into our tale.
My guest is Curtis Hanson, director of L.A. Confidential. He'll be back with one of the film's stars, Russell Crowe, after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Curtis Hanson, director of the new film L.A. Confidential. Also with us is Russell Crowe. He plays one of the three cops the story is built around. Bud White, a cop who doesn't think of himself as very bright, but knows how to work over suspects to get information. Crowe was born in New Zealand and raised in Australia, where he still lives. He made his American debut in the film The Quick and the Dead, starring opposite Sharon Stone. He played a neo-Nazi in the film Romper Stomper, a gay son in The Some of Us, and co-starred with Denzel Washington in Virtuosity. I asked Russell Crowe to describe the cop he plays.
Bud White is a very basic meat and potatoes, blue-collar kind of guy. You know, he sees things in a very clear-cut manner. He knows or believes he knows the difference between right and wrong. And even though when I first read the script, I saw him as an extremely immoral man using his badge and authority for his own ends. After a while, and having read the book, I began to see it from the other way around. I saw him as a very strong moral center who has a great belief in the things that are important to him, you know, and he will fight and die for those and what he believes in.
I think that this is the kind of part where a lot of who the character is just kind of projected by him and isn't necessarily registered through the dialogue, through the words on the page. And I think there's something you bring to the role, a kind of sensitivity beneath the brutality that is conveyed very well by your face, your expression, your body. And I was wondering if you could describe a little bit what you thought about there in terms of the just physical presence of the character and what that needed to be.
Well, we had very long discussions, me and Curtis, about who he was. And at first I was a little scared and freaked out because in the book it's Bud White is described as the largest man in the Los Angeles Police Department.
Which you are not at all. No,
that's why I rang Curtis and said, I don't know what you've seen. It must be smoke and mirrors because I ain't that big. But, you know, we did a certain amount of physical work in terms of, large weights and stuff, you know. But I didn't want the guy to be cut or anything because it's 1953 and just the way he lived his life and what he eats and all that sort of stuff, he just wouldn't be that kind of physical presence, you know. But there's a sort of thing that happens when you're playing this kind of role. If it's on the page, it's very easy to fulfill it, you know. Sometimes you're asked to take a huge leap from what's on the page and what's actually, you know, expected. But this is a really good script, and that's where it starts from when you're an actor.
Curtis Hanson, you said something very interesting, and I think it was a New York Times article about how people looked different in the 50s. Bodies weren't aerobicized the way they are today, and actors didn't have those like rippling, sculpted muscles the way they do today. So I'd like to hear from each of you how that affected the movie. Curtis Hanson in your casting, Russell Crowe in the way you carried yourself.
Well, Terry, that was part of the, you know, challenge of casting this picture in which there are 80 speaking parts was mm-hmm. to try and get the look of that period. I had the, you know, great good fortune of working with Mally Finn, who's just an extremely dedicated and tenacious casting director. And the goal was to find men that looked like that World War II veteran 5-8 years later, who is not gone soft exactly, but in that time when men drank hard, smoked hard, and ate lots of meat and never thought about going to the gym or, you know, working out.
Oh, you mean I was typecast?
Russell Crowe, do you have those rippling muscles?
I think it's just dependent on the character. If it's important to the character, you know, to get to that level, then fine and dandy, you know. But it's based on the character, whether you're playing an anally retentive Welsh Baptist virgin or whether you're playing a, you know, meat and potatoes tank of a man like Bud White. You've got to fulfill who it is that you're playing, you know. And if it's a requirement that this guy is part of his life or whatever, you know, dictates that he's going to be very physically fit, then you go that way, you know. I think as a young actor, once you've been exposed to the performance of De Niro in Raging Bull, you realize that we're beyond any very simple explanation like method or whatever of what you do. It's about immersion in the character, you know. And as Curtis will attest, you know, one of the things that we did on this movie is James Ellroy and Curtis came up with the fact that the Bud White wouldn't be a beer drinker. So for 5 months, I didn't have a beer. And that, for a young Australian, was absolutely torture.
How did you decide that this character wouldn't drink beer?
Well, James had this thing going on that that Bud White's colleagues drank beer, and he didn't want to be turn out like that them, you know. So even though he's very basic kind of working class guy in that time period, and it would seem that beer would be his thing, he's not the kind of guy who'd spend 3 or 4 hours shooting the breeze after work, you know, just talking about rubbish like his colleagues do. So, you know, he's got another agenda. You know, after his normal shift, he's still got things he pursues in terms of being a policeman. So James came up with this thing that Bud White drinks only single malt scotch straight. And that was part of Curtis and Brian's script as well. You know, and the one time you actually do see him ask for a drink, it's when he's doing the first interrogation scene with Lynn Margaret Bracken, and he doesn't take a single sip from the glass because he only asks for the drink to relax her. That's an interrogation technique, and all the cops that see the film go, "Hey, man, he's trying to get it to relax." Okay, yeah, this guy's smarter than he might than he looks.
Why don't I actually play an excerpt of that scene? And this is the scene where Russell Crowe's character, a cop, goes to the house of a prostitute who is a Veronica Lake lookalike, played by Kim Basinger. And this is an excerpt of their first encounter together.
There's blood on your shirt. Is that an integral part of your job?
Yeah.
Do you enjoy it?
When they deserve it.
Did they deserve it today?
I'm not sure.
But you did it anyway.
Yeah. Just like the half dozen guys you screwed today.
Well, actually, it was only two. You're different, Officer White. You're the first man in 5 years who didn't tell me I looked like Veronica Lake inside of a minute.
You look better than Veronica Lake. Pierce Patchett.
He takes a cut of our earnings and invests it for us. Doesn't let us use narcotics, and he doesn't abuse us. Can your policeman's mentality grasp those contradictions?
He had you cut to look like Veronica Lake.
No. I'm really a brunette, but the rest is me. And that's all the news that's fit to print. It's nice meeting you, officer.
I'd like to see you again.
Are you asking me for a date or an appointment?
I don't know.
If you're asking me for a date, I should know your first
name. Forget I asked. It was a mistake.
Curtis Hanson, how did you cast Kim Basinger opposite Russell Crowe? Did you have them do an audition together?
No. I met Kim actually at the Formosa, which is the setting of a couple of key scenes in the movie, and described the movie that I hoped to make, and more or less just told her that she was in the picture. Because my feeling was that Kim would not only be able to pull off the Veronica Lake lookalike aspect, but that Kim, more than most anybody, would recognize that Veronica Lake image, the long blonde hair over the eye, that powerful image was both an asset and a trap. You know, it's all we remember, really, of Veronica Lake. And I thought that Kim would be anxious to play the woman behind that image. What I wasn't prepared for, quite frankly, was the degree to which she came forward as an actress. And again, this gets into the difference between image and reality. I didn't know Kim. I only knew her sort of by reputation. And I wasn't prepared for the degree to which she came forward as an actress and literally placed herself in my hands with an unbelievable amount of trust and courage.
It's so hard for actresses who are no longer ingenues to get a role. And I think that the fact that she is a mature woman enables her to portray the kind of cynicism that she gets across in the movie. I think it adds depth to the character.
Well, Terry, I do too, although I wouldn't actually have used the word cynicism. I think Kim Basinger's part, which is not the biggest part in the movie, but I feel it is the emotional anchor of the movie. She is the one character that knows the truth about herself, and, you know, she knows that she is selling this image, that that's how she makes her living, whereas the other characters are sort of struggling with themselves. She knows the truth about herself, and she sees the truth in others. And she has arrived at this point not because she was, let us say, the brightest person that ever walked, but she has arrived there by the journey that she has gone through. And there is a spareness and a simplicity and a truth to her performance that I think comes from the fact that she brings a sort of the wisdom of years of experience as a woman, the character I'm talking about.
And so you wanted an actress mature enough to bring that to the role?
Well, I felt that she would bring that to the role. And, you know, personally, I am tired of the sort of cliche in movies of always seeing older men with much younger women. I thought, rather than working against us, doing something different would actually work for us in mm-hmm. this picture.
Curtis Hanson directed L.A. Confidential. Russell Crowe is one of the stars. It's won Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Screenplay awards from the New York Film Critics Circle and the Los Angeles Film Critics. Coming up, linguist Jeff Nunberg on the word cult, as in cult group. This is Fresh Air. Now that we said goodbye to the year that saw the bizarre mass suicide of members of the group Heaven's Gate, our linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the origin and use of the word cult.
Not long ago, I gave expert testimony on behalf of a small religious group involved in a civil suit. They were submitting a motion to enjoin the other side from referring to them as a cult on the grounds that the word was prejudicial and subjective. It seemed a fair enough point to me. There are people who'll tell you that cults are a well-defined category, but it'd be hard to show it from the way we use the word. There are a few certifiably deranged groups that everybody calls cults, like Heaven's Gate or the People's Temple, but beyond that it gets a little fuzzy. If you look on the web, you can find anti-cult sites that apply the word to everybody from Amway to Islam to the United Pentecostal Church. The press tends to be a little more selective than that, but there's a lot of subjectivity there as well. In the interest of science, I made up a cult quotient based on how frequently the press applies the word to a particular group. If you set the Presbyterians at 0 and the Heaven's Gate group at 100, then the Branch Davidians have a cult quotient of 96, the Scientologists are at 71, the Unification Church is at 62, and so on down to the Jehovah's Witnesses at 21 and the Masons and Amway tied at 2. This can all get pretty arbitrary. Take the Tibetan Buddhists. They have a cult quotient a lot lower than the Sufis, the Hindus, or even the Mormons. In fact, they're on a level with the Methodists. But all this means is that the Tibetan Buddhists are a politically respectable group whose American advocates are comfortably middle class. The one thing that surprised me was how recent this pejorative sense of the word turns out to be. The word cult itself didn't come into general usage until the 19th century, and even then it was just a slightly erudite label for a system of religious worship, particularly for ancient or exotic creeds like the cult of Aphrodite or the cult of Vishnu. Or you might use the word metaphorically to talk about an exaggerated devotion to some idea, as in the Wordsworth cult. But it wasn't until very recently that the word acquired the sense of spuriousness and social deviance that it has now. In fact, the earliest dictionary that I could find that includes that sense was published in 1961. It's odd we never had a special word with this meaning before then. After all, the history of American religious life is nothing but the account of one eccentric sect after another, from the Puritans to the Methodists to the Mormons to the charismatic and evangelical movements of our own century. And that's not to mention all those European secessions and schisms that fled to our shores so they could do their theological bickering undisturbed. It's true that most of these groups were nowhere near so weird as Heaven's Gate or the Jonestown Temple, but they clearly struck contemporaries as just as outlandish as the majority of the groups we now call cults. The 19th century mainstream press heaped just as much ridicule on Joseph Smith and Mary Baker Eddy as its modern successors have heaped on L. Ron Hubbard and Sun Myung Moon. So where did we get this new idea of cults from? In a word, from the East, along with the Eastern language and religious doctrines that began to have an influence in the West around the middle of the 19th century. Charles Dickens and Wilkie Collins were among the first to exploit this theme with their fanciful tales of opium-smoking devotees of the Indian cult of Thuggee that the British had repressed in the 1830s. That connection gave us the word thug, not to mention a line of melodrama that stretches down directly to films like Help and Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. And there was all the muddled Orientalist mysticism of the Theosophists and the Spiritualists, people like Aleister Crowley and Madame Blavatsky, who wrote about various Eastern cults and helped to popularize the word. By the way, Madame B also had a lot to do with introducing the word guru to the West. By the mid-20th century, it seemed natural enough to extend the word cult to refer to any small religious group that struck people as flaky, wherever it happened to originate. It all made for a reassuring account of where all those weird new religions were coming from. Calling them cults made them seem qualitatively different from all the old-style oddballs that grew up natively in our soil.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu, Monique Nazareth, Kathy Wolf, and Lauren Krenzel. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Remy Martin, Cognac, France, since 1724. Information available, 800-678-REMY. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
If one of your New Year's resolutions is to get serious about putting some money away for your retirement, tune in to the next Fresh Air. My guest will be Mary Rowland, author of the new book, A Common Sense Guide to Your 401k. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.